This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey is about to mark the first anniversary of his heart and liver transplants. He's one of the very few people in the world who has had this double organ procedure. Casey was dying of a genetic, incurable liver disease that was destroying his digestive system and his heart. He was diagnosed in 1990. Last June, at the age of 61, he checked into the hospital so that doctors could evaluate whether his heart was strong enough to withstand a liver transplant. Not only was his heart too weak for the procedure, the doctors thought he was too sick to return home. Within 24 hours, he was the recipient of a new heart and liver. He returned to work on December 21st. Casey is a Democrat and has served as governor of Pennsylvania since 1987. Earlier today, we called him to reflect on this past year. I asked Governor Casey what he thought his odds were when he went in for his dual transplant operation.
I wasn't really thinking of it in terms of odds. You have to understand the frame of mind that I was in at that time. I was in a situation where I'd been told by doctors that this condition I had called familial amyloidosis was not susceptible to any cure, and there was no treatment for it. So I was really without hope in terms of any kind of cure. Suddenly, out of the blue, and there's a long story connected with how this came about, but just let me go right to the bottom line. I met and talked to Dr. Thomas Starzl at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and he told me that he could cure the condition with a liver transplant. So that my choice at that time was either going with a disease which was always fatal over time, or having a liver transplant. So viewed in that context, I was delighted, frankly, to have the option of having a liver transplant, which later became, of course, a liver heart transplant. But still, I wasn't thinking of odds. I was thinking of the choices that were available, and viewed in those terms, the choice was very simple for me, and I was confident that it would be successful.
You know, there's that old saying that no one on their deathbed wishes they'd spent more time at the office. I've always figured that depends on what the office is. When you were going in for surgery, and this was pretty serious stuff, how much did you think about politics, your work, how you'd spent your time in office?
I wasn't thinking about politics, to be honest with you. I was thinking about the immediacy of what was confronting me, and I was pretty much focused entirely on that plus the family. It's a very personal, very emotional time, and I was thinking about pretty basic things like life and death and family relationships. I have a large family, and I'm very close to the family, and that was the focus of my concentration, not government or politics or the job.
Your surgery was June 14th. You returned to office December 21st. And when you returned, you said, "I came back because it was my duty to come back." What did you mean by that?
Well, I was elected by the people to serve a four-year term. And I just felt that if I was able to do it, and I felt I was able, and subsequent events have proved that I was correct in that, I have been serving full-time since then, that I had the duty to do that.
Many people find after they come close to death that when they get better, their priorities change. Do you feel that your political priorities have changed at all since your return to office after the transplants?
I don't think so. I think that they've intensified in some ways, but I think the priorities are pretty much the same. I'm the same person now as I was before the surgery. One thing I think I'm much more sensitive to in this current healthcare debate is the necessity for preserving quality of care in that effort. And if we sacrifice quality of care to the idea of just, saving money for its own sake, we'll be making a tremendous mistake.
What areas do you think your feelings were intensified after the transplants?
Well, I've had a very strong interest in children. Many of our programs are, for example, our Children's Health Insurance Program, which we just put into effect, provides health insurance for and health care for poor children and for children whose parents work but can't afford to pay the cost of the health insurance in the private sector. I think certainly the importance of that priority has been intensified by reason of my experience. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm. One of the big issues facing you now in Pennsylvania is the death penalty. There's a lot of pressure on you now to sign death warrants. The death penalty is legal in Pennsylvania, but no one has been executed by the state since 1962. And I'm wondering what it's like to have power over life and death in that situation after having been given a second chance at life yourself.
Well, my position has been consistent with respect to the death penalty. And when I ran for this office, I said that once a judge and jury decided two questions, one, guilt or innocence, and then secondly, the level of punishment, that I would carry out that decision. On the other hand, I've been scrupulous in taking time to review cases that come before me before signing death warrants, and that's led to a lot of controversy in our state. But I still think, and I'm firmly convinced that, you know, signing a death warrant should not be a rubber stamp exercise, and it should not be subject to any kind of arbitrary time limits.
Let me get specific about what's facing you in Pennsylvania now. There was a state bill requiring the governor to sign death warrants within 60 days of the state Supreme Court turning down an appeal. You vetoed that bill, but the House just overrode your veto, and it's likely that the Senate will override it next week. What would you do if the Senate also overrode the veto and then you had to sign a death warrant within 60 days after that person lost an appeal in the state Supreme Court?
Well, I'd be bound, of course, by the legislation unless it were upset or set aside by a court, and that's always a possibility. But given the fact, I mean, I disagree strongly with the legislation. I vetoed it. So that gives you an idea of the position that I take on the bill, because I don't think that the legislatures ought to be telling governors how to conduct their business any more than governors should be telling legislatures how to conduct their business. I'm not advocating a law that requires that legislators vote within 60 days on every bill that comes before them, or that judges decide cases within 60 days after they've been submitted.
You've signed 16 death warrants since being in office, but 15 of those people won appeals, and the 16th person still might. Some people speculate that your strategy has been to only sign the death warrants of people you're confident won't be executed because they'll be able to appeal. And in fact, there's been some speculation that you're really morally opposed to execution, but you're not comfortable coming out and saying that.
Well, let me just tell you, I've signed 16 death warrants since I'm governor. That is more than the total combined number of death warrants signed by my four predecessors going back 30 years. So, I mean, what's the big deal now? My predecessor signed six death warrants affecting four individuals, the same people that are now yelling for speed and hurry up and what's the delay. Where were they then? This is nothing but politics, pure and simple, in an election year with people playing to the grandstand. It's the oldest trick in the book, and they're just playing it again.
Do you have a personal position on the death penalty?
Yes, I've already told you. I said that I would support it if a judge and jury come to that conclusion, and I have, in fact, supported it 16 times. What do I have to do, stand up on top of City Hall in Philadelphia and yell that to the world?
My guest is Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey. 1 year ago, he had a heart and liver transplant that saved his life. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey. Governor, one of the issues you're best known for is your opposition to abortion. In fact, it's your name that's on the Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood of Southeast Pennsylvania versus Casey. That's a decision that upheld restrictions on abortion, including a waiting period. I'm wondering if your medical experience, you said that your medical experience intensified certain beliefs that you had. I wonder if it had that effect on abortion.
Well, it certainly intensifies my respect for life and the value of life. And in that sense, I think it certainly underscored and reaffirmed what, in my personal view, is probably the most important moral issue confronting this country right now, which is the question of whether we're going to be a country that takes the lives of 1.6 million unborn children every year, or whether we're going to be a country and, frankly, a political party to which I belong, the Democratic Party, which has historically protected the powerless from the powerful. In every other case, that has been the history of my party. But unfortunately, the party has lost its way and now singles out one class of individuals, namely unborn children, just as they singled out Dred Scott back in the 1850s, and have said that that class of people has no rights.
One more related question on this. Some people who oppose abortion because they believe it's the murder of unborn babies support the death penalty, even though that's the execution of somebody.
I mean someone like me.
Many people are called hypocritical if they oppose abortion, but they support the death penalty. And I wonder if there's any connection in your mind.
There's a fundamental difference. The unborn child is blameless, is powerless, is totally without protection, has done nothing to violate the laws of the country. By definition, someone who's on death row has taken the life of someone else and committed a very serious crime, the most serious crime that you can commit. So to compare the death row case, the death row inmate, to the unborn child, I think is obviously just totally different.
My guest is Robert Casey, the governor of Pennsylvania, and Tuesday marks the first anniversary of the day that he had a liver-heart transplant. He returned to office in December of 1993. Governor, physically the heart keeps us alive by pumping blood, but metaphorically we always see the heart as the organ of emotion, love, and feeling. You have somebody else's heart beating in your body now. Does it feel fundamentally different in any way? You also have a younger heart pumping in your body. The donor was 34 years old. Are there any physical differences that you feel having somebody else's heart in your body, or any like metaphorical differences that you feel?
No, there's no physical difference whatsoever. I mean, you're not even aware of the fact that you have someone else's heart. It's an unusual feeling when you reflect on it, to know that someone else's heart is beating in your body, but there's no physical difference in terms of how you feel at all.
Mm-hmm. How much do you know about the donor, and how much do you want to know about the donor?
Well, I've learned quite a bit since the event. And normally, you know, the donor remains anonymous, but in my case, the press sought out his family, and he was a young 34-year-old African-American who lived in Manesson, Pennsylvania, which is not far from Pittsburgh. And a series of articles had been written, one principally that I remember in the Washington Post, that commented on the improbability of the intersection of these two lives, his life and mine. The real tragedy, of course, is that he had to lose his life so that I could continue to live. But the Post story pointed out in very poignant and, I think, moving detail how the things I've tried to do as governor in job creation, in investing in communities like Denora, like Manesson, like Johnstown, like Uniontown, places which historically had been left behind and forgotten, that here was a young man who lived in one of those towns and who actually participated in a job training program that I put into effect to find employment for the unemployed. I had been to Manesson, his hometown, just a few weeks before my surgery and a few weeks before his death, went to the very building in Manesson, which is not far from Pittsburgh, a steel town formerly, but now, of course, steel is gone. But in that town, we had a job training program. I went there to give awards to four single parents, four mothers who had moved from welfare to work. And in that very building, Michael Lucas, who was the donor of my heart, had gone and participated in a job training program, which had led to the possibility of a job not too long before he unfortunately lost his life. So all these things were pointed out in the Post story, and I think the incredible intersection of the two lives and the fact that, you know, I had dedicated my governorship to places like Manesson, to people like Michael Lucas, and then I later, of course, was saved by his generosity and the generosity of his family. I think it's a pretty moving story.
As you say, you know, a lot of people don't know who their organ donor is. It's usually that's usually kept confidential. Do you think you're better off or worse off by having that information?
Well, in a sense, I think it's better. I mean, it gives me a perspective. It gives me a greater appreciation for the generosity of of his family, and his mother has been extraordinarily generous in looking upon this whole tragic event from her point of view as being the opportunity for his life, although it was taken violently. And by the way, that was the second son she lost to violence in her lifetime.
Yeah, the son who was your organ donor was beaten to death.
That's right.
By a drug gang. And according to this Washington Post story that you just alluded to, they were probably looking for the wrong man.
That's correct. And it was a case of mistaken identity. So it just adds to the tragic nature of the whole a series of circumstances. But the point I want to make is his mother, Mrs. Lucas, has told me that she views Mike and my life and what I do as a continuation of the life of her son. And I think that's an extraordinarily generous outlook to have under the circumstances.
You have the heart and liver of an African American in your body now, and I wonder if you identify any more or any differently with African American issues.
Well, I've always been a strong supporter of equality, and I've mentioned some of the programs that I've championed as governor. But this is one of the things that my feelings it's intensified greatly since the surgery, and that is that we're all the same. You know, once you get beyond the color of our skin, we're all the same. And heart is a heart, and liver is a liver. And I'm the beneficiary of the universality of the human condition. The fact that that those who try to drive wedges between us and try to divide us on arbitrary, discriminatory bases like the color of someone's skin do a tremendous disservice to this country. And it's a malignant kind of cancer that's still with us, unfortunately, and we've got to continually guard against it. And I hope to be able, through the rest of my life, to continue fighting for that kind of principle.
My guest is Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey. 1 year ago, he had heart and liver transplants that saved his life. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey is my guest. We're reflecting on this past year since he had his heart and liver transplants. There was a lot of debate about the politics of organ transplant priorities. You had your heart and liver transplant within 24 hours after the request went out. And some people say you got priority because of your stature and your power. And I know the University of Pittsburgh, where I think your surgery was performed, says that its rule is to give the person who needs a dual transplant priority of those who are just waiting for one organ. What did you think of the debate that your transplant caused over who gets the priority?
Well, first of all, when I first met with the doctors at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, I told them right out of the gate, I said there's a list of rules that control the priority allocation of these organs, and I want you to assure me now, each of you, that you're going to follow those rules to the letter. And the rules were followed to the letter, in fact. The rule that was followed in my case was not only the rule at the University of Pittsburgh, it was the rule that was common to the entire region in which the University of Pittsburgh operates. The country is divided into regions for purposes of allocation of organs. And at that time, there was a rule which said, if you need two organs, there's a separate list for dual organ transplants, and I was at the top of that list. The other thing I would mention is that many people don't realize this, but a substantial percentage of people who get transplants get them within a short span of time after they enter the hospital. The cases you hear most about are the ones that have to wait, and this, of course, is most unfortunate and something that is a challenge confronting the medical community now where transplants are concerned. Having said all of that, I can understand, it's perfectly understandable that people would react the way they did to the speed with which I got my organs, but the fact of the matter is that the rules were followed to the letter, and the fact also is that many other people have similarly benefited just exactly as I did.
Governor, just one more question, if I could keep you for one more minute. As we're getting more and more technically advanced with what we can do medically, we're getting into a deeper and deeper financial crunch with what we can afford economically to do medically. And so in re-examining the healthcare system in America, a lot of people are saying that some of the very expensive high-tech procedures will have to be minimized in order for us to accommodate more more routine procedures within the medical system. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I think that's a normal kind of reaction because of the high cost of transplant procedure, but I don't think it's a valid position for this reason. Number one, when you look at the total expenditure for healthcare in this country, transplantation is an infinitesimal percentage of that overall cost. Number two, the investment in a transplant procedure, while it's in the individual case, it's a very high amount of money, a large amount of money, the cost-benefit ratio between that investment in terms of survivability and quality of life is far superior to other kinds of high-price, high-cost procedures that one could mention. So that I think it would be a great setback for the country if the health care plan, if it ever comes in Washington and the states, would eliminate that transplant availability. As you know, it's covered now by almost all health care policies. I have the same health care policy as governor that every other state employee has, and the transplantation procedure has been a covered benefit for many, many years, and I hope it continues to be.
Governor, I thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Nice talking to you, Terry.
Robert Casey is the governor of Pennsylvania. He had his heart and liver transplants June 14th, 1993.